Hello, and welcome to another episode of Endeavors. Hope you enjoyed your last week. Sorry I took the last week off. It was spring break, and I also was feeling a little under the weather, which was unfortunate. There's definitely something going around at my workplace. It's a great, great, great show today. I have actor and producer Lee Dowd, who talks about basically being a biracial actor and what that means and how Hollywood still gets it wrong. And you'll also hear from Dave Moffat of the Moffats. They're back. They've reunited, all four of them, for the first time in close to 18 years. And they're out with a new single called Secrets. So that's all coming up on today's show. My first guest currently stars in the second season of the web series I'm Fine, which is currently available on the streaming service Deco. He also recently wrote a piece for The Advocate entitled "The Gay Community's Fear and Loathing of Asian Men Must End." He was also recently seen in the indie feature film K-Town Cowboy, an LA Asian Pacific Film Festival award-winning dramedy based on the web series of the same name. Originally from San Francisco, he was raised in a multicultural household. His father of Caucasian descent, mostly German, and his mother of Chinese descent. And initially, he had gone by his Chinese name when he was younger, and it's only within the last 5 or 10 years since his acting career has taken off that he's gone by his traditional birth name. From countless stage productions to the big screen, he's built a promising acting career. His film credits include The Amateur, Fifth and Almeida, The Trees, Barely Legal, After Jake, and Another Stupid Day, and he's guest starred in TV shows such as House of Lies, Californications, and Last Man Standing. He is Lee Dowd, and he joined me last week to talk about his career. Lee Dowd, hello, welcome to the show. Thanks for being here this afternoon.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
So you're season two of I'm Fine. I think for a lot of people, this show can tick a lot of boxes in terms of representation. And I know you've said going into season two, you wanted to inject a lot of your own experiences into the character. What was that conversation like?
Well, it happened over a few tequilas, admittedly. You know, Brandon Kirby, the creator, and I sat down for dinner and drinks one night and started talking about where, you know, I wanted my character's journey to go. And, you know, I asked him what his thoughts would be. You know, we brought in a few of my own personal experiences as an Asian American millennial in Hollywood in 2018. And he loved the idea. He thought it was a really great fit. I mean, the show itself follows young people here in West Hollywood in their mid to late 20s, and it is this kind of universal feeling of being lost and trying to find yourself, your identity, in a world that's, you know, created around social media, dating apps and things like that. So when I, you know, talked to Brandon about wanting to bring in some racial issues as well, things that I was experiencing, he really loved that idea, and I was really, really grateful and happy for that, because it kind of gave me a platform to talk about things I found to be really important.
I think when we talk about the issue of representation, people, I think, have a misconception of what that is, and that it's more than one thing. As an Asian American, how do you find that that community is being represented in 2018?
I mean, it's changing, and it is changing pretty quickly, I think, with a lot of the new shows that have come out over the last couple of years, like Fresh Off the Boat and Dr. Ken, which unfortunately was recently canceled. There has been an increase of Asian American representation in both television and film. You know, but that being said, I think there's still a long way to go. I mean, yes, we're starting to break these stereotypes of just being, you know, the techie geek or the sidekick or whatever. But, you know, I still think that there's a disconnect of, I guess you could say, leading actors, leading Asian American actors in leading romantic roles. I think, you know, I talk a lot about how I feel that, especially for Asian American men, that they've been desexualized in a way so that nobody really looks at them as, you know, the strapping young man who's out to get the girl. So I think things are changing, and I think things are changing for good. But it's going to take some time. I still think that there's a lot of preconceived notions and stigmas around, you know, Asian American actors.
And you were also raised in a mostly white suburb. I'm curious how you sort of were able to use both, like, look at both sides of your heritage and bring that to any role that you play.
Yeah, I was. I am half white and half Chinese. You know, the Caucasian side of my family is, we've recently kind of discovered that we're mostly German. We used to think there was a little Norwegian in there, and I don't think that's the case any longer. But, you know, I think growing up, I grew up outside of San Francisco in a suburb, which was very open-minded and liberal, and I never felt different. I never felt marginalized. I went by my Chinese name for a long time in grade school and middle school and high school. You know, sure, there may have been a few playground jabs here and there, but like nothing ever was really all that, I guess, offensive. And it wasn't really until I grew up and moved to LA and tried you know, my hand at acting in Hollywood, that I realized that I was different, or that people were seeing me differently. And, you know, being mixed race, for me, is a blessing. I get to see and experience multiple cultures and you know, have different experiences. But, you know, I think some of my experiences in Hollywood have been shaped just simply based on the fact that I'm not enough of one or the other. You know, I'm not white enough, or I'm not Asian enough. And that then kind of brings into question, you know, what is considered enough when it comes to roles, when it comes to characters on film and TV. And if someone is not Asian enough, is that because there is an idea of what, you know, an Asian character should be? Sorry, I kind of went off on a diatribe there. What remind me of your question one more time?
It was just about, you know, given that the fact that you are mixed race, biracial, how do you sort of use both sides of your heritage and bring that into any role that you play?
I mean, I think I bring a lot of myself to every role that I play, and it's, you know, my experiences as someone of mixed race, as someone who was born outside of the United States and moved here at a young age, and, you know, I've traveled back to Hong Kong to see family. I'm very lucky in the sense that I have experienced a lot in life with these different cultures. And so I get to, you know, bring that into my work. You know, does it? Yeah, I mean, that's kind of how I incorporate that into my life.
You mentioned that you went by your Chinese name as a kid, and that you started using your legal name, Lee, for professional reasons. What does it say about Hollywood that many Asians or even African Americans or Latinos have to whitewash their names if they want to succeed.
Yeah, that's a fascinating question, and I think it's I guess this was back in what 2008, 2009, almost 10 years ago now. I sat down with my very first agent in Hollywood, and at the time, she was afraid that going by my Chinese name, that I would be pigeonholed and really only then going out for Asian roles. And when she looked at me, she was like, "I just don't see you going out for only Asian roles." So at the time, I then decided to go by my legal first name, which was Lee. And that, I don't know, it was a strange experience. It took me a really long time to get used to it, and then it just started to become incorporated into my everyday life. And I think especially for Hollywood, it's they want to understand. They want to be able to, a lot of times casting wants to be able to just put you into a box to understand who you are from a photo and a name on a piece of paper. And so I understood at the time why my agent wanted to, I guess, whitewash. I don't know if I guess it does come from the white side of my family. But, it's not, it is my name. It's not like I turned around and, made up an American name just to have one. So in from my experience, it is a little different because it, legally was my name. But yeah, I also understand a lot of Asian actors have to kind of adjust their identity in fear of becoming typecast.
But do you find that, I mean, even though you're using the name that you are, that because of your background, you're still only being offered certain roles, or a certain type of role? 'Cause I know you mentioned earlier that we don't see a lot of Asians getting to play lead roles in films.
Yeah, I mean, I auditioned for quite a few different roles, a variety of roles, if you will. And the thing I find, to be funniest is that a lot of times when I do go in for roles that are written for, Asian specific, that I find that I'm not Asian enough, or that's what my people are told later on, is that, they went with someone who looked a little more traditionally Asian. And that's so broad. I mean, it's also, there's so many different cultures within the Asian community, whether we're talking Korean, Chinese, Japanese. And a lot of times it is, that I think is another challenge in and of itself, is that there's this kind of generic term Asian actor, but I think there's a bunch of different things that can be brought into play here. I mean, I'm a Chinese American actor versus someone else who might be Filipino American or from Vietnam or whatever it is. And then I think that will come later on, is, I guess not necessarily separating all of them, but being able to identify different cultures and different ethnicities within this overall broad term of Asian American actor. But that's, that's a lot of, those are a lot of the problems that I come across in Hollywood, is that, they want someone who's Asian American, and I show up and all of a sudden I'm not Asian American enough because half of me is Caucasian.
Another thing that you've talked about in your article that you wrote for The Advocate is the desexualization of Asian males within the LGBTQ community. And I think you're right, is that there's a certain, I think, description that we're used to seeing of Asian males within that community. What are some of the problems with that you see in terms of how that community is perceived?
Within the LGBT community, you mean?
Yes.
Like how the Asian males are perceived within the queer community.
Fascinating. I mean, I think a lot of times, and I say it in my article, that it's not necessarily about rape itself, but more of the perception of rape. And there's a stigma for a lot of Asian American men within the LGBT community that, they're, either too feminine or submissive or whatever it is. And then on the flip side of it, a lot of times they're just looked at as asexual or just desexualized completely. I think it stems from mainstream media. It's not necessarily just queer media that is portraying Asian American males this way. I think mainstream media has done its part. And for me, growing up in the 90s, kind of looking at what was considered, I guess, iconic or sexy, it was always that kind of Abercrombie and Fitch style Adonis. A straight white male, heterosexual white male, has always kind of been the, I guess, the ideal. And I think that has translated into the LGBT community and what is considered to be attractive or sexy in that sense. So I think a lot of people of color, and this doesn't just pertain to Asian Americans, but within the LGBT community, people of color are either fetishized to an extreme or they're desexualized completely.
It's funny, like I remember when I was growing up, all the Asian actors I would see would be action stars, people like Jackie Chan, Jet Li. How realistic do you think was that a portrayal of people like that, and why did it take us so long to see Asian Americans or Asian actors in films other than action movies and shoot 'em up films?
Yeah, I mean, I think what we're trying to do so much now is show that that we're multifaceted, that we're not just about kung fu. Is that's not the only defining characteristic of Asian American actors in film and television. While I think a lot of those skills are incredible, and I wish I could do it. Not every single Asian actor is falls into that category. And yes, I mean, you're right. Growing up in the 90s with Jackie Chan and Jet Li, even Bruce Lee, in the decades before that, they were showcasing these incredible skills, but it was in a way almost one-dimensional. I talk a lot about the best example that I have is from Romeo Must Die, the Jet Li and Aaliyah film. They're supposed to have a bit of a romantic connection that is written into the script in the film itself, but they're in an R-rated film that's full of violence and action and blood and all this stuff. Their sexual relationship, their romantic relationship is so PG-13. And so I think that is also kind of factored into what I talk about as desexualization of the American or the Asian American male. If it were a different film, if we were watching a Jean-Claude Van Damme film or a Schwarzenegger film, I don't think they would have danced around the fact that, that leading man, Jean-Claude Van Damme, Schwarzenegger, whoever, Bruce Willis, they wouldn't have, I guess, dumbed down that romantic relationship as much. In fact, they probably would have had romantic scenes, sex scenes, whatever it was. But I think in Romeo Must Die specifically, as the the image that popped into my head, they really just focused on Jet Li's martial arts skills and not his skills as a sexy leading man.
It strikes me that there are, and you allude to this a bit in the article, this idea of sort of casual racism. You talk about, in the world of online dating, you know, people say like, oh, you know, no Asians, no Hispanics, not racist, just a preference. What is your biggest issue with that? I mean, are people entitled to say that on their private profiles?
I think what I want people to realize is just how harmful those words can be, and that, you know, just because you say it's not racist, just a preference, doesn't change the fact that it's racist. It's sexual racism. You know, I do say that we're all entitled to have a type. We all have a type based on what we've been exposed to in our lives. You know, especially in those formative years. But by discounting or excluding an entire group of humans simply based on skin color, that's racism. That is actually the definition of racism. You know, are we going to be attracted to every single person that we come across? No. And I think that goes for all races. And I don't see any need to write, you know, not into blacks, not into Asians, because I mean, how can you in your brain just know that you're never going to be attracted to someone from that group? You know, I think the best way I can kind of put it, and I write this in the article, is that, you know, let's say that there's two people left on Earth, and you've said you're not into Asians, and that means if there are two people left on Earth, you could potentially exclude one of those people as a mate, as a partner, simply based on skin color. Everything else aside, you know, we're talking size, shape, personality, survival skill set. All those things could be set aside, and you could make a decision simply based on race. You know, I want to discourage people from saying things like that, from excluding groups of human beings, you know, simply because they feel like they're not attracted to the ones that they've encountered thus far in their lives. You know, I had a lot of people come back to me after that article came out, and they said, well, if I'm not attracted to women, does that make me a misogynist? And the answer is no. You know, I think you are born the way you are, whether as straight or gay, somewhere in between. That's biological. I don't think that racism is biological. You don't come out of the womb knowing that you're not into Latinos or that you have an affinity towards African Americans. That's something that is learned later on. And so that's why I wanted to just kind of question where some of these things are coming from. When people say no Asians, I want people to know, why are you saying no Asians? Is it because you've never seen you know, a sexy Asian American male portrayed in the media? It's very likely. I think that that has a big influence on what we find to be attractive, is what we've seen in film and television and movies. And I kind of go back to the fact that the heterosexual white male has kind of been, I guess, at the top of this pyramid, you know, been put up on that pedestal for so long that people have it in their brains that they may not be attracted to something else, but really it's just them being a little bit closed-minded.
How much of that is exposure, though? Because in terms of what our type is, if you're only, you know, exposed on television to, you know, a certain group or a certain type of people, does then that feed into the idea of what the perfect type of person is?
I mean, I think a lot of it has to do with exposure. Not all of it, but, you know, I think a lot of it has to do with exposure. And not necessarily understanding somebody else's cultures or ideas or whatever it is. And then I think that means there's something kind of subconscious and dormant that lays a little bit deeper inside of us that, you know, causes some people to think, oh, well, because I've never seen a sexy Asian American, I'm not into Asians. Or, you know, I think on the flip side of it, it also can go and turn it into a fetish, and over-sexualize something that hasn't really been, you know, at the foreground of the conversation. So yeah, I mean, I think it has a lot to do with exposure. And I think that has kind of influenced a lot of people's attractions and wants and needs and desires.
Well, the TV series is I'm Fine, and the second season is available on the streaming service Deku. Lee Dao, thanks so much for your time this afternoon.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me. I appreciate it.
Alrighty, have a good day. Cheers.
You too.
That was Lee Dowd. The second season of I'm Fine is streaming now on Deco. Here are the Moffats with I'll Be There For You. Scott, Clint, Bob, and Dave. Of course, they were the Moffat brothers, or simply, the Moffats. I don't know about you, but I got a little bit nostalgic listening to that. If you're a kid of the 90s, they were your favorite boy band. And, like so many boy bands, they went away. After their harder-edged album, Subnormalities, was released in 2000, they were still only in their teens, and they decided to go off and do their own thing. Clint and Bob ended up in Thailand, and Scott was doing some stuff here at home, and Dave had kind of left the business for a while and was teaching yoga in Winnipeg. But luck would have it, after various collaborations between the brothers over the years, all four of them are back with a new single called Secrets. I spoke with Dave Moffat a couple weeks back to talk about the reunion, the new song, the new album, and how they're still so big in the Philippines. This is my conversation with Dave Moffat.
Dave Moffat, hello, welcome to the show. Thanks for being here today.
Hey, thanks for having me.
So, the four of you are finally back together for the first time in 17 years. I'm curious about the decision to reunite, because I know, like, Scott, or, like, Clint and Bob had done their own thing, Scott had done their own thing, yep. The three of them had done their own thing, but you were sort of the one that hadn't fully committed to coming back to music in until recently. Why was now the time for you?
Well, actually, we were asked to do a show in the Philippines, because we had heard news that there was still, like, a lot of people wanting to hear new music in the Philippines. We had a big reaction. And so my brothers were actually all invited back to the Philippines, but I wasn't able to go. I've been teaching yoga for the last 8 years, and I had some prior commitments that I just didn't feel right backing out of. But then I was able to see the concert and watch, you know, what they had done when they were in the Philippines, and it was like kind of mind-blowing, because it has been 17 years. It's been a long time, and but to see the reaction that they received was, like, kind of mind-blowing. So I felt like, yeah, you know, if I get the next, if there's another opportunity to do something, I definitely want to do it. Because I love music, and I was writing. I was planning on doing some solo stuff, but I just didn't feel like it was the right time for me to do it, and I was kind of being pulled into a different direction, which ended up being yoga, which I think was the right path at that time. But we went to Nashville, Tennessee. We recorded a brand new record together, and it was a really great experience to be able to, you know, work in the same room. It was kind of nostalgic, and it felt good. Yeah, it was an enjoyable process.
You know, here are your four brothers from Northern BC, and arguably your biggest audience is the other side of the world in Philippines and in other parts of Asia. What's that atmosphere and sort of that realization like for you guys, especially at this time in your lives?
Well, I think that music is different. I mean, I think that in North America in general, we're so accustomed to having new artists and new music come out, and we kind of, since we've gone back together, the response that we received from Canadians has been pretty loud, to be honest with you. But I think that in Southeast Asia, like in the Philippines, for instance, we had the number one selling record of all time. Like we outsold the Eagles Hotel California, so it was kind of. I think that it made a really big impression on the country and in other parts of Southeast Asia as well. That allowed us to stay in the minds of a lot of the people there. So it gave us that opportunity. But the opportunity to go back to Southeast Asia is also
giving us the opportunity to just release music in Canada and throughout Europe, wherever, you know, we had success before, where people are kind of wanting some new Moffat stuff because it's been such a long time.
You know, boy bands have a notoriously short shelf life in terms of the in a lot of ways, in terms of their career trajectory. For you guys, the decision to walk away after Subnormalities, what went into that? And in the larger picture, do you think it has to do with the fact that a lot of boy bands start out so young that's why their career trajectories are often a lot shorter?
Well, I think that the situation with us, I think that it was a bit different, only because we wrote most of our own music. Like our last record, we wrote the majority of the songs on that record, and so we're all different people too. We're siblings with different you know, appreciations in music, and sometimes I think that creates. It creates one flow, because you've got a flow when you're a band, especially when you're that young. You have to find you know, an equal or an even footing with everyone else. But we were also getting older, and I feel like we needed to find our own identity with music. We needed to explore what it was that we personally liked, because our identity was so tied up in the Moffats. But now that, you know, we've taken a lot of time away from, you know, being together, we've definitely found our own likes, and we've been able to excel a little bit more at what we appreciate in music. And we're also at an age now where we can come together with more respect or appreciation for, you know, what we individually can bring into the sound that we're creating.
The fact that you guys are all brothers, how do you think that affected the relationships? Because we see some siblings get along, like Hanson, for example, and then Noel and Liam from Oasis hate each other. So in terms of the creative relationship between the four of you.
Well, I mean, I think that even Hanson, I think that, like, you know, those guys have got to have their moments as well where they're not always getting along, you know? Like, there are always going to be moments where heads are butting. That's just the reality of family, I think. It's not always a perfect situation, but there are moments, like especially when we're on stage, all the four of us together, when we're really gelling, those are the moments that really bring it together. But, you know, when we're off stage, there are definitely moments that, you know, where we're acting like family, the way that only family can act with one another, which is good, because you know, it's not always amazing, and it's not always bad. There's always a place in the middle where we can find appreciation from both sides, I guess.
And you guys also played your own instruments, which was unusual for boy bands of the age. Was that always a conscious thing that you knew you folks wanted to do? Had you always played from a very young age?
Yeah, we started playing when we were, I mean, essentially when we started to sing, we were playing. And I think that, like, we never took dance. We never did anything like that. That was never something that, I mean, we appreciate good dancing. I'm sure all of us do, but it was never a part of the music that we were growing up listening to. We listened to bands. We listened to, you know, real electric guitar and drums, and, you know, Michael Jackson and a couple other pop artists definitely snuck in there, but majority, it was more, you know, 80s or 90s rock. That really was the main influence with the Moffats. And, you know, Chapter One, A New Beginning, was definitely had a very pop boy band feel to it, but we were really young at that time, and it was our first pop record deal. And, you know, when it's your first record, you go a lot more with the flow of, you know, what the record label is wanting you to do, the trajectory in which they have in mind. So it had a lot to do with that. Not to say that we don't appreciate or look back fondly on that record, because I think that we all do. We all love singing "I'll Be There for You" and "Miss You Like Crazy" still to this day. But before that record was made, we were like grunge. We were like rock. When people would come to the show, it was a rock concert. And I think that probably 2 years after Chapter One was released and we were touring, our concerts really went back to that very rock concert style of show, because we were playing instruments and it was more of the genre that we felt comfortable on stage performing, you know? So I think that's what also transitioned to our last record, Submodalities, which definitely had more of an alternative feel to it.
So let's talk about Secrets. That's the new single. In terms of the writing process, where did the idea come from? How do you guys work together? Do you all write separately? Does one of you take charge of the lyrics?
Well, the record was, we all had a part in songwriting on the record, but Secrets in particular was written by Bob Clint and another songwriter in Nashville, Tennessee. And they were, I'm not exactly sure what the intention of the song was when they were writing it, but we were always pulling from a sense of personal experience, something that we've gone through, or something that we know is relatable, that we've experienced, that we feel will connect, on a large scale. So Secrets has, that just, take away the mask, let's just be who we are, being with somebody for, who they are, not the mask that they put on, is really what that song is all about. And, in the world that we're living today, it's easy to put on masks. And, when you're putting on a mask, sometimes it's not so easy to have an authentic relationship. So I think that that's really where the idea from that song derived from.
How easy was it to get all those photos from fans? Because I know in the end of the music video, you sort of make a note that you got all these fan submissions.
I'm sorry, I didn't really understand the question.
I correct me if I'm wrong, but I think in the end of the video, there was a little text saying that a lot of the pictures and the images came from fans. So what was the solicitation process of that like?
That was actually really interesting, because, the whole reason why this new record was made was because there was, this real verbal, outcry from our fans that really wanted to hear new music. And we felt with Secrets, it was a really great way of reaching out and connecting with the fans. And, when our fans back in the day, they were around the same age as us, 16, 17, maybe 15 or 14. And they've all grown up. A lot of them have had children or have gotten married. So it felt like a really good way of tying in, reaching out to those fans and bringing them into, the story of what this record is all about, which was a really fun experience. And it was great to see the video and see all the, emissions coming in. And, it was a really cool idea that we came up with. We think it worked out well.
Just in terms of the business aspect, how different would you say the industry is? Because when you guys broke up in 2000, it was sort of the very, very early days of streaming. Like, it was just Napster. Everyone was still listening to CDs, and now it's streaming individual songs. How are you finding that aspect of it all?
Well, I'm not one to fight against the realities of the world. I think that, even social media was like non-existent when, MySpace wasn't even around when the Moffitts disbanded. But, it's just the way that the world is going, and that's going to change as well. I'm kind of intrigued to see where it's going to go. But, you look at the reality of what the industry is like, and you kind of need to move with it. If you want to make it work, if you want to make it happen, you can't be rubbing up against it. You got to find a way to work with it so you can be reaching as many people as you can.
Do you think that is this for you guys, is it just going to be a reunion, or is it going to be a full reformation? Have you guys sort of mapped out the future at all?
Well, I think that we're kind of taking it one step at a time. As you said earlier, Clint and Bob have been doing, you know, their Endless Summer project, their country music. It's kind of, you know, it's kind of country folk, really easy listening to duet, you know, the two of them singing vocal and harmony. And then Scott's got his record that he's already recorded, and he's also producing some music at the moment. So I think that if it happens where we actually come back together, it would have to happen in an organic way. But at this moment, it's more of a reunion to give back to the fans and the support that they've given us. You know, the fact that they haven't forgotten about our music or what it meant to them, you know, when they were 16, 17 years old.
I think another interesting thing that's happened, is, you know, between then and now is these host of sort of music reality shows, competition, whether it's Idol or The Voice,
for sure,
or even something like Got Talent. And I know you have a little bit of experience with that, but what is your take on that aspect of the industry?
Well, I think that's a good question. I think that there's a place for it, but I think that there's one thing that we just need to be aware of when we're watching shows like that. There's so much talent in the world. There's so many talented vocalists or songwriters or performers or artists. And I don't want people to be, or their talents to be disposable. You know, I feel like there is a little bit of a leaning for that to happen with the reality TV and the music combined. You know, we see some really great singers come on the shows and we're blown away by their performances or their talents, and then literally they're off the show like the next week or 2 weeks later, and then they're never heard from again. That's kind of a sad thing, you know, because it's an opportunity for people to really showcase their abilities. But I think that also it's a little different. You know, you can be a great singer, but it doesn't make you necessarily a great artist, right? Like, you have to have a vision of who you want to be and the music that you want to sing, or an idea of at least how to write so that you can express your prerogative or point of view that makes you authentic and a unique individual as an artist. And I think that sometimes in reality TV shows that are based in music, if that's not really something that's accounted for. Maybe that's changing. I'm not sure. I know there's a new reality TV show. I haven't watched it, but I do know that I think that that's a valuable thing, a commodity to have as an artist, is your own prerogative, your own point of view. It's not really always good enough just to have a good voice. If you really want to have sustaining power or longevity in your career.
We mentioned Hanson earlier, and I had a lot of fans asking me about whether you guys and you and them will ever collaborate, maybe on a song or maybe even doing a tour in the vein of the Backstreet Boys and New Kids doing like the I'll Be There for Mbop tour or something like that.
You know, I would never be opposed to something like that. I think they're really talented guys. I went to one of their concerts in Nashville, Tennessee, and, you know, very impressed with their abilities, and they have their own prerogative as musicians. You know, they really pull from the 70s, which is kind of an interesting era to pull from, especially in today's music. But, you know, I think that, again, if something like that were to happen, it would definitely have to be organic. It would have to just come together organically. But again, I wouldn't be opposed to something like that, for sure.
So you guys are going on a big tour, I think, starting next month, if I have that correct?
Well, Clint and Bob are actually doing a tour next month in Southeast Asia. I think they're going to, like, 8 or 9 different countries there and putting on a show in each country. But that's for in the summer. I believe that later on in the year we'll be doing some Moffitt stuff, possibly in Southeast Asia, but that's all kind of in the works at the moment. And as for a Canadian tour, we've discussed it, but again, nothing has been set in stone, and if that were to happen, it'd probably be next year.
Right. And I know that this single is out now. Is there a date set for the EP release yet?
There's no date set yet. We're really taking it slow because we're doing it very independently. We really want to see how, you know, our first single, Secrets, goes, you know, with just the natural drive from the fans and having them call to the radio stations requesting the song. It's a very indie sort of project. I mean, we recorded it and produced it by ourselves in Nashville. And we're just kind of, we're taking it slow because we think that Secrets has a lot of potential to do really well on radio. And, you know, with the way that radio works these days too, you know, especially with pop radio, they have their selection of music and they really play it hard. So we're just trying to break in through that, you know, that system that's in place right now. And I think that, you know, we're going to give it a couple, maybe a couple more months with Secrets. We've got a couple other singles that we're excited to be releasing. And Secrets is definitely a little bit more on the alternative side, considering that this album, again, was intended for the fans. And, you know, if new people end up picking up the Moffats and be like, oh, these guys are great, then that's awesome. But because it is more of a give back to those fans, we definitely wanted to... I think that the mindset was creating an album that was kind of in between Chapter One and Submodalities. Because I feel like it was such a big jump for our fans to go from one record to the next. And I think that this record was kind of that bridging from one to the other. So we've got some really great ballads that are going to be slated to be released. And yeah, I'm excited to see and hear, you know, the feedback and, you know, what the fans think about it when that stuff does get released.
How do you feel about the Canadian music scene in general these days?
Well, to be honest with you, I'm actually pretty impressed and proud. You know, there's a lot of really great Canadian artists that are just slamming all over the world. They're doing such a great job. You know, Alexia Cara, you got The Weeknd. And these, you know, they're right up there. Obviously, Justin Bieber, he's killing it. He's been killing it for a while. But, you know, I was in the States, and I was hearing so much Canadian music while I was there. And I was thinking, yeah, you know, that's pretty great. It's great to have, you know, Canadian talent being showcased. It's really all over the world. So that's pretty, it's impressive and, it's pretty cool. I like that.
Well, the new single is Secrets, which is out now, and we look forward to the release of the full EP sometime in the near future. Dave Moffat, thanks so much for your time today, man.
Yeah, thanks for having me. Have a great day.
Alrighty, you too. Cheers.
Thanks. Bye.
That was my conversation with Dave Moffat, taking you out with their new single, Secrets. Be sure to follow the show on Facebook and Twitter at Endeavors Radio. And if you like what you hear, consider donating to the show's Patreon page at patreon.com/endeavors. Here is Secrets by the Moffats. Thanks for tuning in, and I'll see you next time. Bye for now.
Trust me, I got no reason to lie about what's deep inside. Girl, I want you to see me. I promise this is the real me. I know you've been hurt.